Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the fifth lecture of the 2018 Palliative Care Lecture Series. Hospice New Zealand would like to thank and acknowledge Cancer Research Trust New Zealand for their generous support and funding to deliver these free lectures. The lecture today will be recorded and it will be available on the Hospice New Zealand website. Please be aware there will be an opportunity for questions at the end of the presentation. We would now like to introduce our guest speaker today. Dr. Ross Drake is a consultant in paediatric palliative care and complex pain service at Starship Hospital in Auckland. Welcome, Ross. Please go ahead.
Hello, everybody. Good to see all your fine faces out there. So I've titled this talk Complex Pain Management, the Old and the New, and I'm always dubious when people put in the terms old and new in a title. So you should be dubious as well. But there is a lot of research going on in pain, which is yet to make clinical impact, but there are things coming along the way. We won't delve into those so much. Rather go through new classification addition to the pain world. So I'm a clinician, I work at Starship, I'm a paediatrician first and foremost, and then I've done my training in palliative medicine and then in pain medicine. I, in my job, I'm lucky enough to combine all three. So if we go to slide two, I'm going to start us off in a clinical setting with three cases across the age range in my world of paediatrics. The first is of a newborn baby girl who, for inexplicable reasons, needs significant resuscitation at birth, a term baby. And as you can look at the gases recorded off the umbilical artery, the pH is in a dire range. Not unexpectedly, this baby has seizures within the first day of life, and standard now is head cooling, which is shown to improve outcomes. However, the EEG on the third day of life indicates this baby has minimal brain activity, and the MRI confirms what is clinically evident as a severe global hypoxic ischemic injury. And even at this early phase, you can see quite significant changes within the brain, even in the deeper structures, such as the basal ganglia and the pons. So the baby was extubated with the expectation of death, and that's why the palliative care service is involved. But this baby survived, as so often happens. And then ensued a period where this baby remained irritable right up to the time of discharge from the hospital at 3 months of age. We go to number three. We're talking now about a young 8-year-old girl who twists her ankle, her right ankle, 3 weeks earlier, and despite doing all the right things and showing of no fracture, and the MRI scan showing no structural damage to the ankle, she has escalating pain. This is a prequel to that injury. This 8-year-old girl had, in the past 18 months, had repeated about 5 ankle strains, 3 of the right ankle and 2 in the left ankle. And the most recent ankle injury was still was happened on the basis of a twisted right ankle 3 weeks earlier, which she had not recovered from pain-wise. So she presents on crutches with pain now spreading up the leg from the ankle up to and above the knee. We go to number 4, and we meet a 13-year-old young female. She has advanced Ewing sarcoma. And I think the word sarcoma for anyone means potentially poor outcome, and certainly a Ewing sarcoma and does not have a great outlook, particularly when it's advanced, as in this girl's case. he has a left renal primary, metastases in the scapula and in the right kidney. And she goes through the usual treatment protocols, and by 3 months after completing treatment, she had a relapse in her skull, presenting with headache and double vision, and radiotherapy actually does a good job in resolving those issues. And she's into the second cycle of palliative chemotherapy when she presents with several weeks of escalating pain in her right shoulder blade and in her back. We go to slide number 4 or 5. I think we'll all agree that all three of those children at some stage in their illness trajectory had what we know as nociceptive or acute pain. And that is defined as the activation of nociceptors that arises from actual threatened damage to non-nerve tissue. And that can be somatic, so in the limbs, or visceral. But I'd like to take a step back, and we go to number 6. And when I presented a similarly in the past, I've always asked people what they consider to be pain, and or ask for their definition. And most people come back with the words, it is what the person says it is, that it's an unpleasant experience, which are all very true. And the International Association for the Study of Pain defines it as an unpleasant sensory and emotional experience associated with actual or potential tissue damage, or described in terms of such damage. I think the essence of pain is to get your attention so that you can escape the potential damaging situation, the danger that exists, and then protect yourself, heal. But then I move on to slide number 7. I scan the room, and usually there's very audible gasps and sighs, and I'm sure some of you have done that in seeing this poor man's fate, all pumped up with hope as he runs down the launch runway to the long jump, all pumped up full of hope and steroids, looking to fly to a new record when the tibia forms a new joint. The fact that most people in the audience would grimace or audibly sigh, or even in some cases when I've asked if the audience is large enough, people experience some level of pain themselves, really says that pain is an emotional experience even for those who watch on. And this is part of what we'll explore today. So, we'll go right back to the 1500s, so very old. And this is Descartes and his model of pain. You have the boy who puts his foot in the fire, and through a rope and pulley system, rings a little bell in the brain. And if you press the next die for 8, you should see that pain is and only can be an output from the brain. Everything else before that is a message. And if in my explanations to children, I talk about the messages from anywhere within the body to the brain as being a danger message. We go on to number 9. We look at this in more technical terms, and Clifford Wolf has been very active in this field, and we'll meet him a little bit later. The pain receptor, or the nociceptor, is multimodal. So it can be set off by a group of different sensations, hot, chemical, pressure. And the key point here is the little blue fella on the end, the inhibitory cell, regulates the message to run through and be experienced as pain, whereas the feather touching the A beta fibers, the low threshold, large fibers, they travel through as touch and don't move over into pain. We go over to number 10. So how does that look for the chap who's just broken his leg? Essentially, you have a massive inflammatory response in the peripheral area, and there's a whole variety of different receptors that are activated potentially through the macrophages, the mast cells, the platelets. All that will get released into an area of damage. But the key, and off to the side you'll see ringed, is glutamate. Glutamate is our excitatory amino acid or neurotransmitter. And that has a key role in not only acute pain, but chronic pain as well, or complex pain. And then on the other side of the receptor, you have the various potentially inhibitory neurons, which we'll come to later. I mean, and to make sure that you protect that area, the area becomes sensitive. So the foot becomes sensitive, or the leg. And if you don't take notice, that sensitive area increases. So you get recruitment to make sure that you really take notice and allow yourself to heal up. Moving on to number 11, which brings us to the next type of pain, so nociceptive and then neuropathic. And just in a way to show that how this you can conceptualize neuropathic pain. So this is where we have injury to a nerve. The nociceptor is sensitized. You get an activation of the C fibers, which are the danger transmitting fibers, if you will. Release of your glutamate, excitatory amino acid, and activation of the NMDA receptor, which then sets up a whole cascade, and you get a hyperexcitability in the spinal cord. So let's go on with number 13. And a young baby who's 3 months old, found ischemic insult to the brain, who's incessantly irritable. So high-pitched, unrelenting scream. Able to be settled with touch and gentle movement, but anything more than that with head stimulation worsens the situation, such as getting into the car seat. So this family's locked at home, unable to move or go anywhere, isolating them further. And not unexpectedly, again, the baby develops high tone and the musculature with back arching so severely hypertonic. If we apply a pain scale to this baby, we get an average pain rating of 6 out of 10, ranging 4 to 8. And parents, being sensible as they are, have tried the simple analgesics, which have had no effect whatsoever. And the downward effects of this condition are increasingly evident with trouble feeding, slow development and seizure activity alongside of this high-pitched, unrelenting scream. Nightmare for families to deal with. Move on to 14. So if we had to say where this baby's problem is likely to sit, there's been a massive insult to the brain, so there's and the MRI evidence of lesions within the somatosensory nervous system, and in this case it's a central neuropathic pain condition, which is also better described, I think. I don't think there's any literature other than maybe a case study or two on children with central pain, neuropathic pain, but in adults there's a reasonable amount of literature for post stroke central pain, and also from multiple sclerosis, which is a group of people not uncommonly seen within palliative care in the in-out area. And it is up to 30-40% in that group can develop a central pain condition, with the lesion often found in the somatosensory nervous system. So directly within often the thalamus, and it's the anteroposterior nucleus of the thalamus that's the most likely to cause this issue. The only other thing about this is that it's not necessarily an immediately noticeable problem, and that some of these adults post their lesion or their problem developed it up to a year after. So the third pain I want to talk about, which some of you may have heard about and many of you may not have heard about, is nociplastic pain. The reason why you may not have heard about it is because it only became a classification of pain in September last year, after the International Association for the Study of Pain did a 18-month process of working out whether or not it should be included. So nociplastic pain, what is this? Well, in clinical terms, if we go to the 8-year-old girl with the increasing pain up her leg from a simple ankle injury, albeit repeated, she now has a constant aching, throbbing pain up to 5 centimetres above the ankle. And those descriptors, aching and throbbing, would normally be associated with inflammatory pain, so acute pain. And she also has spontaneous, what she describes as shock-like flares. Well, I describe shock-like flares. I think hers were more like being zapped. The intensity, again, averages in the severe range, 7 to 10 out of 10, with the flares up at the 10. So not uncommonly children will say it's 15 or 100 out of 10. Touch causes pain, so she can't bear the bed linen on her foot. It sleeps with her foot out of the bed. The impact is quite profound. She's not attending school. Her sleep is disrupted. She's significantly anxious and fearful of moving that leg, and her mood is getting low. Again, simple analgesics, and after a couple of trips into ED, the use of morphine and fentanyl were totally ineffective. And in examining her, it's very noticeable that her right lower leg and foot are cooler to the touch compared to the left. The skin is mottled and of the blue-purple hue. And there's swelling when the foot, particularly on when the foot becomes dependent. So, in a quick testing with light brush, warmth and cold indicates she has pain with those sensations. But she has allodynia, and in light of there being no demonstrable damage in the foot, this girl has complex regional pain syndrome. Number 17. So nociplastic pain. It's pain that arises from altered nociception, despite no clear evidence of actual threatened tissue damage that causes activation of nociceptors or evidence of disease or lesion of the somatosensory system. So essentially, pain with no demonstrable cause. And I recognised this pain as being present in children in palliative care, and I think in adults in palliative care, although it's not the field I work in. And one particular condition, which will come to near the end. So nociplastic, I apologise, it should read nociplastic pain. We go to number 18. So we meet Descartes, who in the 1500s had the boy in the fire with the the roof and pulley system showing their pain as an output. It took 400 years for the knowledge of pain to advance with Malzack and Wall in 1965. He came up with the gait control theory. And in brief, if we look at the little diagram of how pain works, you've got the S stands for the small nerve fibers, so they're those C fibers, the danger message transmitters. And then you've got the L fibers, which are the large nerve fibers, which transmit messages such as touch or vibration. And the resting state, there's a third cell in the middle of those called the inhibitory cell, which constantly fires and holds those inactive. Now, if you do have a touch to the foot, then the large fiber fires up. It actually continues the activation of the inhibitory fiber. So that allows the message to go through as touch to the brain rather than as projected on through the projection cells into pain, or the P cells, the pain cells. Whereas if you have the small fibers fired up, say from that long jumper snapping his leg, then it inactivates the inhibitory cells, opening up the pathways that the brain then transmits into the various pain pathways, the somatosensory pathways. So we have acknowledgement now that the nervous system, particularly the spinal cord, acts as an inhibitory pathway. So it can block messages going to the brain. And the commonest way to think about that is that you're all sitting in your seats, you're listening to this talk, and you don't kind of realize you're sitting in your seat because you don't need to. The message is still being sent by your bum. You just need to block it out because you're attending to other sensations around you that are more important. You kind of know you're safe and comfortable in the seat. When you're not, then the messages break through and you shift around until you get yourself into a comfortable position again. That's essentially the inhibitory system. Going on to the next slide, which is 19. So how do opioids work? Well, the opioids work on that inhibitory system. The inhibitory cells, we look at the little yellow cell, and you look at the round close-up, they release endorphins. Endorphins are a natural opioid. Otherwise, we would not have receptors available for morphine and fentanyl and oxycodone and the rest of them are methadone. So they release endorphins, which attach to post-synapse. They attach to the cell to be activated. Whereas, so morphine and like works at that level on the opioid receptor to inhibit the release of that exciting amino acid, glutamate. And so you get a reduction in transmission of pain messaging, hence a reduction in pain. Now we skip on to and meet for the first time or second time Clifford Wolf. So his photo is right there. Clifford Wolf is the man who came up with the idea of central neural sensitization syndrome, nociplastic pain. And his work, which came 20 years later, so we didn't have to wait another 400 years, 20 years later, and the aha moment for Professor Wolf was he'd been working with his rat models for a few months when he suddenly worked out that by giving them a little electric shock on the hind paw, why the variation in responses occurred over the day, so that at the beginning of the day the response was less than at the end of the day. And that led to his theorization of excitation within the nervous system, and subsequent work from him and many others have solidified central neurosensitization. So if we look at neuropathic pain in the central nervous system, on the left-hand side, you've got acute pain with the release of glutamate, which sets off the AMPA receptor, but the NMDA receptor remains closed with the magnesium molecule in the middle. But if we go to chronic pain, so under bombardment with repeated release and large amounts of release of glutamate, you dislodge the magnesium and you open up the NMDA channel, which gives unrestricted flow of calcium, and it sets up a whole cascade of new changes and loss of inhibition and neuropathic pain. Now, see, plastic pain similarly has the release of glutamate, the inflammatory response. The inflammatory response in the central nervous system, which largely is in the spinal cord, is a massive activation of that little purple cell, the microglia. Now, when I was at medical school, and you have your hour lecture on nerve cells, the bulk of the talk was on astrocytes, but probably 2 minutes was on the microglia. That may have been improved now, some many years on. But the microglia are a surveillance cell. They work in a very similar way to the macrophage, which I've arrowed. And under the bombardment of glutamate, so a lot of continued danger signaling, they increase in number by 1,000-fold within the dorsal horn nucleus. And if you think about where that dorsal horn nucleus exists in the spinal cord, if you did a transection and cut a slice of the spinal cord, you get a very much like a butterfly shape with the large wings being the top of the spinal cord. Then if you coloured those wings in as the colour of the rainbows, so the dorsal horn nucleus would sit in the orange range, so red, orange, yellow, going down that way in the second stripe across. And the microglia activated, and they release all the various cytokines and interleukins that you would get from a macrophage within the dorsal horn nucleus, getting a point of sensitivity and the danger signaling without any other injury peripherally will now activate the brain to give you pain in that area. So hence the 8-year-old girl with the foot that is blue and cold and swollen. That is all central neurosensitization. But if it's long enough, you do get changes within the brain and you get laying down of pain memories, and we'll come to that as well. Number 23. So let's recap. Nociplastic pain. If you essentially, if you go to what was that bright blue cell, the inhibitory cell, that is now less active. And in fact, over time will actually degenerate. So you lose the inhibition. Now the stimulation of the nociceptor leads to unregulated and amplified pain messaging. So what we would notice as hyperalgesia, increased pain response and prolonged pain response. And the loss of inhibition also allows the touch receptors, the messaging from that, to be diverted into the pathways that will lead to pain, and hence touch becomes painful, or what is known as allodynia. Number 24. Now we come to the brain, which at the get-go we decided was the only thing that can give you pain. So there's three pathways. One, the messaging goes from the spinal cord into the medulla, and then onwards. The first is into the projection neurons, those P neurons we talked about earlier, move to the somatosensory cortex to locate where you're sore and to tell how sore you are. So the somatosensory cortex, location and intensity. If we go to the orange pathway, the descending pathway, the brain sends back down to the spinal cord as engaging a negative feedback to block unnecessary messages. So a reinforcement for those inhibitory cells. On to 25. Let's go back to adolescent who's coming to us with escalating pain in the shoulder blade, which you have managed with your usual medication, and because of itch, moved to fentanyl, which has been working wonderfully well, until there's several weeks of escalating and spreading pain. The young lady describes this in multiple different ways, but the most prominent thing now is the pain is in the whole body, with the exception of the head. It is severe and constant, and the flares are unbearable, and the doses of fentanyl have gone into almost the industrial realm, and many of you will go, aha, this is opioid-induced hyperalgesia, which we will see if it is. Mum's concerned her daughter's depressed, she's lost her spark, her communication's down, she has angry outbursts at home, which is unlike her, and she's isolating herself from her family. Friends, she is just retiring to her room and distracting herself on social media, Netflix, and the like. And in talking with her, it is clearly evident levels of anxiety there, but she doesn't agree with that. She is sweet, and she doesn't feel there's any need for medication for anxiety management or any support from a psychologist or counsellor. We move on to 26. So the formulation here is metastatic deposits are more widespread. It's from some scanning, so I'll add that in, but the spinal cord is clear. Formulation would be from Dame Cicely, total body pain. There's clearly no septic pain because there are deposits of cancer in various areas of the body, so inflammatory and bony. There's neuropathic pain with extension into the brachial plexus. But that doesn't account for the total body pain. And I would suggest that this is an example of nociplastic pain. On to 27. This is still a recap. And I think epic feeds for the slide. Too much time and detail for me to draw up myself. So we start with the periphery, we move through the dorsal wall and up to the thalamus. So at each point along the pathway, there are points of potential management. So there's peripheral sensitization, which is a response to tissue injury. Just above that, there's injury-induced changes to the sodium channel and increased number of sodium channels, so there's an ectopic firing from those. Within the dorsal horn, you get an alteration in transmission of the synapse, and that involves the calcium channel. There's the sensitization we've talked about. T fiber activity drives changes in the second neuron, so that's the neuron that moves to the brain. And there's glial activation and massive cytokine release, which results in hyperexcitability and increased synaptic efficiency. So it becomes more efficient than it should be. And there's reduced inhibition to counter that. So that's an encapsulation of everything we've just been talking about. We go to 28. So management is interdisciplinary, that acknowledges the biopsychosocial model of pain, and it avoids us dichotomizing it between its either physical or psychological, regardless of what the cause or not is. So when working in complex pain, children with non-cancer pain, but also that, but maybe in more not in a palliative setting straight away, but eventually I think it comes along, as well as the need for a graduated rehabilitation approach, which we would use pharmacological approaches, which we'll move into ever so briefly, psychological strategies and therapy program. And I know the fourth talk for this year was from a physiotherapist and the importance of activation of function. And I would totally support those concepts. And that combined three-pillar approach is widely accepted as the most likely to improve outcome. However, not all children require attentive involvement from all modalities. And interventional procedures have a role, albeit limited, but extremely important when they're required. So we've got for this young lady is the consideration for psychological strategies, which she does not want. And then there's the cultural and spiritual needs. But what does that look like for this girl? I think I'll get you to press again, and you should see on slide 30 what happened for this girl. Yes, opioid-induced hyperalgesia was worthwhile thinking about, but actually it came down to communication. No one had a direct conversation with this girl about her outlook. She had many ideas. She was a bright girl. She just needed those ideas validated and the addressing of a few misconceptions. Once that was established, literally overnight, the pain distribution and the intensity diminished down to a level that would be expected for her condition. And her fentanyl requirements de-escalated rapidly as well. That's not opioid-induced hyperalgesia. That is just what is, if we go to number 31, the fear factor. So the second pathway, the blue pathway, if you like, as soon as we get into the medulla, is a pathway that branches off the somatosensory pathway, that or pain pathway, that branches off into the limbic system. The first port of call in the limbic system is the amygdala, a fear center, size of an almond, but fear that can grow to involve your whole body. Fear that will drive the pain to levels unexpected. And that is present both in the young lady with the total body pain, but also in the young girl with the twisted ankle and the escalated pain there. And the amygdala is also our deep memory center. So the laying down or the continuum of that lays down a memory of pain. And if we look at memory, there's three areas of the brain, essentially, if we simplify it down, which I like doing. There's the frontal lobe, or the prefrontal cortex, which is also a pain area. And that's like holding water in your hand. It's there momentarily, but it will drip off eventually in a matter of seconds. The next is the hippocampus. The hippocampus is like carving something into wood. It's there for quite some time, but it's not permanent because it will wear away eventually. And then there's the amygdala, and that's like carving something to marble. Once it's laid down, it's there for you permanently. And there's even the concept that the amygdala may be an area for instinctual memories, memories you're born with. And I'd get you to think about that as the fawn born in the thicket, who pins itself to the ground when the large shadow goes overhead, which is a bird of prey, instinctually knows to go to the ground. How does that fawn know that? Certainly Bambi hasn't given little fawn an indicator that shadow's overhead is meaning death. this is something that is essentially known. We go to 32, and we'll wrap this up into pain as a biopsychosocial phenomenon. You have nociception, pain perception, suffering, and pain behaviors. In each of those areas, you can deal with the problem with various therapies, both pharmacological and physical, as well as psychological. And if we click again, you should go on to the next phase of 32, and that is where central neurosensitization comes into play. And you'll notice that many of the therapies that you had available to you are no longer likely to work, and you have to focus more on the other aspects of restoration, using the co-analgesics and the antidepressants, psychotropics, and physical modalities. And I think what's happened is I have clicked on, and you may be behind where I was, but we should be on slide 32. And there is the end. If we click on to 33,